And there's all the scientific evidence, too, that shows how a gratitude practice is so transformative. And it's related to how we see the world. We constantly parse out the world. Like if I told you, hey, Srini, go out on the street and look for everything that's a color red. Mm. You put on this filter on your brain and you're going to start seeing red cars and stop signs and fire hydrants and all everything that's red is going to jump out to you. And so when we put these filters on our brains and we start to see something in a particular way, it's the scientific side of manifestation.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. This episode of The Unmistakable Creative is brought to you by 2020, where creatives go to get inspiring, authentic stock photos. If you're tired of scrolling through uninspiring staged images, check out 2020. Their images are crowdsourced from real-world photographers, and you can choose from millions of high-quality photos available under a simple royalty-free license. Today, 2020 is offering Unmistakable Creative listeners a free trial of 5 photos so you can see for yourself. To start your trial, go to 2020.com/unmistakable. That's the word 20, then 20.com/unmistakable to get your first 5 photos for free. Thanks to 2020 for sponsoring today's episode. This episode is also sponsored by HostGator. If you're looking to build a website or move an existing one, HostGator can help. They have 24/7 live support via phone, chat, and email, an easy-to-use website builder. If you're not tech-savvy, and if you want to move your existing website from your existing host, they make it free and simple. Visit HostGator.com/creative and use the promo code creative at checkout for 15% off all of their hosting packages. Sarah, welcome to The Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
I'm so glad to be back. Our conversation last time was just, I kept thinking about everything we were talking about before. So now, what, 3 years later? Let's go.
Well, a lot has happened since we last had you here. I mean, your last conversation here was so riveting that we actually managed to turn it into an animated short, which we will link up in the show notes for any of you who are not familiar with Sarah's story. But I want to start a little bit differently this time. And I want to start by asking you, where did you grow up and what impact did where you're from end up having on your life?
Grew up in Palo Alto, California, but I was actually born in Heidelberg, Germany. So my parents were living abroad and they had 2 babies while they were living in Germany. They lived in Germany for 5 years and then they moved to Idaho. Actually, they moved back to their house in Idaho. They stayed there for a few months and then they moved into a house in Palo Alto. And I grew up there. I lived there until I was 18. My mom still lives there. Then I went to college when I was 17. And growing up in Palo Alto has a tremendous amount of privilege and benefits and then also a lot of eye-opening things that maybe people don't necessarily know about. Palo Alto was just recently rated as one of the highest. It has one of the highest cities with one of the highest rates of teen suicide because it's so competitive. When I went to high school, there, I think 20 people in my class went to Stanford and 40 people got perfect SATs. And there's just a really huge range of competition and as well as privilege. There are people who are the kids of startup founders from the 80s and from the 70s and really, really wealthy people. And it was interesting because we weren't necessarily like that. I'm as close to the 1% as you can get. I'm probably in the top 3% if you look at my, like, who I am and where I'm from. And I'm extremely lucky and extremely privileged. And it's why my work is so important to me. You know, the work that I try to do with Charity Water and in augmenting women's voices and people of color. And I spend a lot of my time tutoring and helping and why I'm so passionate about politics in some ways too. But when we grew up, we were in a position of relative, not poverty, but not privilege. I don't know how to say it. Mm-hmm. So my dad went to Stanford and he got his PhD. And while we were growing up, he was making a graduate stipend of $27,000, and we had 4 kids in our house. So when we went to school, they'd have all these fancy programs like, oh, pay a $400 extra and take your kid to the gold rush and learn about the gold rush, or like go do this like fancy schmancy something program, after school program. And my parents were like, what? No, You can read a book, you'll be fine. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize later that it was because there were just four kids and not a tremendous amount of cash to go around. So we got our seventh generation hand-me-downs. You know, I joke that seventh generation soap was made cool by our family because we had our three cousins older than us, and then my older sister, and then me, and then my brother, and my younger sister. And the seven of us would wear the same pants. So by the time they got down to my younger sister, they were like 1979 pants that she wore in 1991, and she was definitely not cool.
Mm. Wow. Okay, so many questions come just from that. you know, one, I'm curious, did the sort of internal money story change from sibling to sibling? Because I can relate to what you're talking about. My dad was a postdoctoral student for most of the time I was in you know, elementary school, junior high. It was when I was a sophomore. In fact, I shared a bedroom with my sister up until I was in the 10th grade. And I'm curious, like, did the internal money narrative change with your siblings as this whole thing sort of evolved? And what was it like for each of you? Like, do you guys have different money stories as a result of having experienced this?
Srini, I've never had anyone ask me that. And yes, yes, it's totally true. My older sister is the one who probably thinks of our family as the poorest, because my dad finished his master's and doctorate degrees and then went on to work at Space Systems Loral and at private aerospace companies. And so our dynamic changed. You know, we had one Volvo that we shared for a decade, and then they got a new car, and it was like, ooh, guys, we have a Ford Windstar minivan. Like, we get to drive around in the big white elephant. But yeah, the money story definitely changed, but it's interesting to see what I hang on to and what comes up time and time again. And even now, as I've written about minimalism a little bit and my behavior around clothes and around spending money and my real desire to save money. Uh-huh. Like, save money and keep money. I'm sure that's rooted in how I grew up. I mean, my first job was, I was 8 when I first started my first kind of quote unquote entrepreneurial venture. Like, I got out our wagon and I made a whole bunch of cookies and I had a lemonade stand, and my mother made me make an Excel spreadsheet. I shared this with my sister. She made me make an Excel spreadsheet, and we like added up the cost of all of the materials. And I was like, okay, if a bag of flour is, you know, like $2.99, but we used a third of the bag of flour, then it was 67 cents of this and then that. And like, we added it up, and then we recorded not just the revenue, but the profit. I had to pay her back for the materials, and I knew the margins of my cookies. I was 8 to do this. And then by the time I graduated from college, so we also had an agreement in our family, we could go to state school because my parents could afford that. Okay. They saved pretty aggressively, but they said no private schools. I did go to a private school because I got a scholarship to cover the cost to make it equivalent to a state school, which was amazing. But by the time I got to college and graduated from college, I'd had about 15 to 18 different jobs at that point. Like, I used to work before school and after school in high school. So I got up at 5 and I was a lifeguard in the morning, and then I went to school. And then afterwards, I studied in the afternoons, and then I went to swim practice from 5 to 7 p.m. Then I ate my face off because I couldn't ever stop eating. I was so hungry. And then some nights, Tuesdays and Thursdays and Saturday mornings, I would work at the pool again from 5 p.m. till 7 p.m. Or I'm sorry, from 7 p.m. till 10 p.m. So I had opening shifts and closing shifts and summer jobs. Some summers I worked 4 different jobs. And by the time I graduated from college, I was really confused by the word entry level on job applications. They're like, well, this is an entry level position. And I was like, what does that mean? Like, what, how do I count my experience? Like, what, I may be new to this job, but I was running pivot tables and Excel sheets when I was 12. So I don't know if that's true. That's maybe a little bit of a fabrication, but like, I'll retract that one a little bit. So it was really always fascinating to me. And I found myself really frustrated with the state of the resume and how we were applying to jobs and what it looked like to sell your experience to somebody, especially when I knew that I knew how to do things. And yet people looked at my bachelor's degree and they were like, oh, you must be brand new.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
You know, another thing that you said that struck me was how competitive an environment Palo Alto is to grow up in, you know, like the teen suicide rate and all of that. Which actually, you know, makes me wonder about how you think about parenting, because I know that you have, you know, recently entered motherhood, because I've gotten a sort of, you know, front row seat to it via Instagram, which has been very entertaining to watch.
Yeah.
But I'm curious, like, having been exposed to this just insane amount of sort of, you know, personal development material, you know, how to live a more meaningful life, you know, self-improvement, everything that, you know, we're kind of immersed in as a byproduct of the work that we do. How is that, and also the experience of what you saw in Palo Alto, you know, how has that affected your approach to parenting?
So I think that's such a good question. So I think one of the kindest things my parents ever did for me was they limited the number of advanced placement classes that I could take. Like, there's a lot of people who are saying, oh, I'm going to take 5 in my junior year, and I'm going to take 5 in my senior year. And my parents are like, why don't you pick 2 that you're really interested in? And AP classes in high school are like taking college prep or college level courses while you're in high school. And what happened was a lot of people were burned out by the end of high school. By the time they got to college, they are drinking a ton and they were tired because they'd been working so hard to be these perfect people and they didn't know who they were. They checked off all the boxes and they worked themselves into the ground. And so when I think now about parenting, yeah, I just had my first kid. He's a cutie, but I'm biased. So I have no objectivity when it comes to him. There's something biological in that. Like, you look at this thing that looks like you and you're like, I love you. Like, you're great. I swear there's something in the hormones where, like, cuteness is a survival mechanism too. Like, I don't think anyone would put up with the amount of work that it takes to make children if you didn't have this very strong hormonal link to this thing in front of you that's taking all of your time. like there's, like, the biology is working. Because this is, you know, top 3 things that I've ever put this much energy towards. But so when I think about being a parent, I think one of the most important things is kind of a paradox. You have to just let go. And to me, it comes in these, like, jokey forms. We have these conversations with Leo, my kid, where I'll do my best. I'm like, I'm going to be consistent. I'm going to set some great boundaries. I'm going to do all these things. And then I look at my husband and I look back at my kid and I'm like, hey, kid, so here's what parents do. They kind of mess with you a little bit. Like, we're just going to screw you up. We're not going to try to, but it's going to happen. And your job is that you get to go to therapy for years to undo what I'm doing. And I think we all just, it's just these patterns of these stories that come down. And once I realize that no matter what I did, there'll be something that doesn't work, or there'll be something that, you know, messes up my kid a little bit, I'm kind of like, all right, we're cool. I messed up. You'll be messed up. We'll figure it out. We'll go from here.
That's funny. Yeah, I remember Philip McKernan, when I asked him the questions very similar to this, he said, no matter what you do, you're gonna fuck your kids up. I'm like, okay, that's kind of a relief. And you know, I don't know if you've ever seen the TV show Parenthood.
Yes.
One of my absolute favorite shows. And the very end, which I'm going to ruin it for people who are listening, but there's this great line where, you know, Craig T. Nelson is with the oldest daughter, and they're having this conversation, and he just says to her, he's like, parents screw their kids up. That's just what we do.
Totally, you look, we do our best and we screw you up.
Like, and you're like, there's such an honest moment in which you suddenly realize, you're like, okay, you know, yeah, I mean, my parents are far from perfect. And, you know, like you said, I mean, you know, it's taken therapy and immense amounts of, like, you know, personal development work to undo whatever bad things they did. But you realize, you're like, oh, okay, this is an incredibly difficult job where there's no, you know, instruction manual in which, you know, things will go according to plan.
Exactly. And also, I think it gives me a little bit more empathy and kind of eye-opening awareness of how hard it must have been for my parents, because I'm realizing that most parents don't know what they're doing. Like, we're just making it up. There isn't an instruction manual. We're doing the best we can on limited sleep and limited time. And we're making decisions on the fly. It's not like we can tell our kid, like, let me get back to you after I research this. You know, they've just taken a, like, giant can of sardines and, like, poured them in their eye at the like at the table, at the dining room table, and they're like, I'm just gonna do this with that. And you're like, I don't know what to do. You know? Yeah. So, like, the other day my little one fell and he chipped his tooth, and I was like, what do I do? Like, what do I do? And my husband was like, he's fine. He's just going to have a little chip in his tooth. And I was like, but did I ruin him? And he's like, no, this is like the least of it. He's going to run into a wall tomorrow. I'll probably give him a bloody nose on Friday. Accidentally, of course, you know, accidentally.
Yeah.
And we realized like parenting is just, I mean, it's not a giant shit show, but it is a little bit.
Yeah. What's surprised you about your son? Like, what are the things, you know, you may have seen this. There's a documentary series on Netflix called The Beginning of Life. And they, you know, it's just a bunch of shots of babies, you know, followed by like really interesting conversations with child development specialists. But I'm curious, like, you know, what has surprised you? Like, what has it been, you know, like to have this incredibly curious human being in your world?
I think what's really interesting is the amount of determination there is.
Uh-huh.
It's baked into you. Like, it's not like it's something that's been like pressed out of us over time. But the beginning of a human life, you see how innately curious and innately fascinated and just unbelievably determined that they are. Like he tries something, he doesn't work. He tries it again. Like, I'm exhausted just watching him sometimes, but he never stops. Well, there's occasions when he's like practicing walking, and then after an hour of it, he just flops on the floor and like throws his head back. He's like, oh, that was hard. And I'm like, yeah, you've been doing that for an hour. Like, if I did what you were doing, that'd be really hard. But it's amazing the amount of determination. And then I think the other thing that really, really surprises me is how fast they learn. He will look at me. And right now we're teaching him baby sign language because he's 13 months old, and developmentally between like 8 months and 18 months, around the turning point of age one, it's easier for them to learn hand gestures and sign language. And there's still just a lot happening in their brain for them to be able to make speech and sounds. Like, it's a really complicated thing to learn speech. You have to understand, you have to vocalize, you have to try, you have to be able to make all of the shapes and sounds, the S's and the T's and the consonants and the patterns are really hard. So hand gestures are easier. So we're starting to teach him sign language. And I looked at him and I made the shape for nurse or milk, which it looks like imagine that you're milking a cow. So I'm squeezing my hand like I'm milking an udder. So that's the shape for nurse. And by the end of the day, he looked at me and he opened his hand and he closed his hand and he opened his hand and he closed his hand. And I was like, holy shit. Like, it just took you less than a day to figure this out. And the next day he learned the stop sign language. And the next day he demonstrated want. And I was just like, oh my God, you are like, you go to sleep and then you wake up from a nap 2 hours later and new neurons have been baked in. Like, you're literally like, you know, the software upgrades we have on our computer. Where it's like, would you like to go to sleep now? That's what I feel like my kid is. They're like, and then it's like rebooted with a new system.
Why do you think that we lose that determination, and how do you get it back?
I have a theory that middle school is the worst time in all of humanity.
I think I share that theory with you.
There's actually some studies out there that say it would be better for parents to just take their kids out of middle school and stay at home. Wow. Than not go to middle school. And some of the damaging things that we do are we put kids into age cohorts with only their same age group, which is possibly the worst thing we can do to children. Like, what children might need, and I think this is true of all people, is a diversity of age experiences. So that child, and more than just their parents, so that 8-year-old and that 12-year-old needs buddies that are 16 and 18, like older kids, older brothers, older sisters. They need mentors. And then they also need, like, let's say 20 parents. They need aunts and uncles. And if they're not blood aunts and uncles, then they need other parents that they can go to when they're embarrassed to talk to their own parents. You know, especially, I'll speak from a little girl's perspective because that's my background. But when you're 12, 13, 14, 15, and you are like, your body is changing in front of you, you're getting breasts, you're getting your period, you're starting to like have uncomfortable feelings, you grow pubic hair for the first time, you're like, things are just changing. Sometimes you don't want to necessarily go to your parents because they might make a too big a deal out of it, but you want to be able to go to that older woman friend, like an aunt, and just be like, I might need a bra. you know, and instead what you get, and this was my experience in middle school, is you go to school and you're not wearing a bra yet because you don't know that you have to do it. And then you have guys making fun of you. And that is traumatizing. It's like really traumatizing to have people make fun of you as you're changing shape. And like, I imagine from a boy's perspective, like your voice is changing and you have to put textbooks in front of your crotch because, you know, like, like it's just as bad for boys. It's just so hard.
Yeah.
And then you read books like, oh, what's that book with Piggy? I'm forgetting the name.
I think I remember it.
Oh my gosh. We're going to have to find it later. I like want to go Google it right now. But that terrible, terrible book about what happens when a bunch of boys get stranded on an island and how competitive they are.
Oh, Lord of the Flies.
Lord of the Flies. Thank you. Like, and how cruel and how mean. Because we're hormonally, we're still like our brains aren't fully developed. They're not developed until we're 25. Yeah. And so we're there and we're at an age when we're like bathing in a sea of hormones. And then also we're like learning to lie because we have to get better at communication, but we get worse at it. Oh my God, it's the worst time. So my husband and I have decided that we're going to have one or two kids. We're not sure yet. In middle school, we want to travel the world. So we want to pull them both out and go live abroad. Because if you learn another language, I think that's better than any middle school.
Wow. Well, yeah, having, you know, when I look back at middle school, I look at it as one of the most like just awful periods of my life. Like, and not only that, I hated my parents during middle school so much so that I didn't even invite them to open house one year because I was embarrassed by their Indian accents.
Oh,
like, you know, so I completely get that. I'm really curious, you know, to talk to you about something that I saw. You may have seen it. There's a new Netflix series called 13 Reasons Why, which is about a suicide of a girl who was in, you know, high school. And, you know, they did outtakes on Q&A at the end. And they said, you know, like for adults today to kind of say, oh, you know, getting bullied and cyberbullied seems ridiculous. You need to, you know, become thick skin. And they're saying, you know, what you don't realize is a lot of the things that people, you know, who are teenagers in junior high, you know, in high school today are dealing with, they're dealing with things that they're not capable of even dealing with because of the way the brain is developed at that age. So like the sting of something feels much more serious than it actually is, which is resulting in a lot of problems. And I'm very curious to hear what you have to say about this as a parent.
Oh my God. I'm a little bit scared about the world that we have in front of us. I mean, I'm also very optimistic. It's something that I look forward to, the new challenges and the new adventures. But I think the current 20-year period we're in where everybody's online and there's unfiltered, unfettered access and people can be so unbelievably cruel. I mean, I remember the sting of even just the slip of a comment. And it's true. Your brain is just, it's categorizing everything on a survival level. You know, do these people like me? If they don't like me, I might die, is what it feels like inside of you at that age. And I want to go back and tell my past self, now that I've made it, like, oh my God, it gets so much better. Like, it just does. Like, 24 was 1,000 times better than 16 and 18, and 28 was 1,000 times better than that. And like my 30s are exponentially better than that. But it does give me a little bit of fear because there was a study I was reading recently where it said that boys, by the time they reach 16 or 18, it might be even younger.
Mm-hmm.
It may be like 12 or 14, 50% of all boys have seen not just porn, but hardcore porn. And the effect that it's having is it actually damages the ability of boys to be able to experience full sexual experiences later on in life. Like, they're no longer able to map these wires in their brain. And I'm not versed enough to know how it works.
Sure.
Like in the cognitive neuroscience of it, but there's something happening where it's blocking our ability to feel emotions and our ability to feel pleasure. And that, like, that should be sending off alarm bells in all of our heads. And then everybody's got a phone. And like, I looked at porn when I was growing up because we're like, oh my God, what is this? I want to see what this is. Good Lord. They do what? Right? Like, I'm never looking at that again. And then 2 weeks later, you're with your friends and you're like, well, let's figure out what that is, you know?
Yeah, I remember asking a question once on Facebook. I was like, what was the very first thing you ever searched for on the internet? And I was like, if people are honest, especially guys, every one of them will say porn. I remember it very distinctly. I walked into my dad's office. I was like, ah, this internet thing. I wonder if there are pictures on here.
Totally.
I think that's just, you know, it's one of your most, I don't know why that would, that is, you know, the thing you're most drawn to naturally. But it's really interesting to hear you say that. So let's do this. Let's shift gears a little bit. I mean, you know, when we were speaking 3 years ago, we really, you know, we focused on your work as a writer, but I mean, so much of what you do has evolved. So I'm curious, kind of, one, how has becoming a parent impacted your work, and, you know, vice versa? And you know, how, like, what have you been up to for the last 3 years?
Yeah.
Other than, you know, making a new human.
Right, making a new human. That was one of my to-do list items. Yeah. No, just kidding. So one of the things that goes part and parcel with writing that I really love doing is teaching. And since we last spoke, I think I was in the middle of putting some online courses together. But I teach a writing course. I teach a content strategy course. I've taught a course called Grace and Gratitude, which is one of my favorite things ever, because it's just a 2-week practice in gratitude. And I had some amazing student responses. And this isn't scientific evidence. This is just anecdotal. But someone told me afterwards, she's like, you know, I've been trying to get pregnant for 4 years and I took your course and then I conceived. And I'm just like, what? How? What? How did that work? You know, well, we don't need to go into the graphic details of how that worked, but but it's the power there's all the scientific evidence too that shows how a gratitude practice is so transformative, and it's related to how we see the world. We constantly parse out the world. Like if I told you, hey, Srini, go out on the street and look for everything that's a color red. Mm. You put on this filter on your brain and you're going to start seeing red cars and stop signs and fire hydrants and all everything that's red is going to jump out to you. And so when we put these filters on our brains and we start to see something in a particular way, it's the scientific side of manifestation. So actually, it's what I did before I met my husband. I had been dating a tremendous number of people. I don't know if I think I told you the story on the last time, but I don't remember.
I don't think
so. Okay. So, I was engaged when I was 25.
That I remember actually.
Yeah. I think I told you this and that one didn't work out. And so I threw myself into dating apps. I was on like Match.com and, OkCupid and a whole bunch of other things. And I think I went on 30 dates in a year. And at the end of it, I got exhausted because none of them were working the way that I wanted to. And I felt I was 27, but I still felt my biological clock ticking because I'm an obsessive planner. I was like, but I have to have babies. When is that going to happen? And then I kind of let go. I said, I don't want to date anymore. I just want to write out what my ideal partner would look like. And instead of listing like, here are the 27 different perfect qualities that someone has, my friend encouraged me to limit it to just 3 things. And so I wrote this story about these 3 things. They were kindness, activity, and intelligence were my top 3. And it took me a long time. I wrote out 10 things that I really wanted in a partner. And then I wrote out 5 and then I narrowed it down. And one of them was athletic. And then I realized, no, they don't have to be athletic. Like we don't have to swim to Alcatraz together, but I need you to be able to go on a walk with me. Like we need to be able to go on a long hike. We have to meet somewhere in the middle. I can do the swimming thing. We don't have to go do triathlons together. Kindness became my number one. How you treat another human being is just such a critical skill. And I started to be able to see how my friends and the people I was hanging out with really owned that quality. And then intelligence, you know, I'm a huge book geek and I wanted to geek out with people. And that was like a no-brainer for me. So I wrote this story and I still have it in one of my many, many Moleskins. And I remember that I wrote it like it was a real human being, not like it was an idol. And the story was something like, I want this person to be, oh, my husband's going to laugh if he hears this now. I want this person to be good looking to me, but not too handsome. Because I don't want to be nervous all the time. I was like, I don't want to be nervous all the time. And I think my husband is the most beautiful person in the world. But I've showed him this and he's like, oh, great. So what am I? You know, he like reads it back. But like good looking to me and not too handsome, because I think if somebody was like strikingly gorgeous, it would make me really nervous. And I want them to be really, really smart and kind. And I wrote this story about like what they looked like and who they were and how they behaved in the world. And I met Alex the next week.
Wow.
And it, again, correlation and anecdotal evidence does not equal proof. The scientific side of me says, though that's a great story, but that doesn't mean it's replicable. But I do think there's something there, and there is evidence that when we paint pictures of what we want in the world, we call forth that thing because of the way our brain works about how we see the world. And he and I didn't start dating until a year later, but we met, we were friends, we wrote letters back and forth for a long time, 100,000 words we counted. And then I flew to New York because I was going to be part of a conference. I was a fellow at a conference called The Feast in New York City. And I told him I was coming. And we went to the same dinner. And it was like, how fast can I make out with you? Like, how fast can we get together? And that weekend, we made out all weekend. And then we started dating right after that.
Today's episode of The Unmistakable Creative is sponsored by Design Crowd. Unmistakable Creative listeners have used Design Crowd for logo, web, and graphic design. Here's how it works. You go to designcrowd.com and you set up your design brief, and you'll get submissions from anywhere between 60 to 100 designers from around the world. If you like the designs you get, you can then approve payment. If you don't like what you get, you can go back to the crowd and ask for more, or ask for your money back. To see what other Unmistakable Creative listeners have designed and save $100 on your first project, visit designcrowd.com/creative and use the promo code creative at checkout for $100 off. Today's episode is also sponsored by our friends at HostGator. They host your website and they have 24/7 live support via phone, chat, and email. An easy-to-use website builder if you're not tech-savvy, one-click WordPress installs, and if you want to switch from an existing host to HostGator, it's free and it's simple. And because you're an Unmistakable Creative listener, you're getting 30% off all of their hosting packages. So visit HostGator.com/creative and use the promo code creative at checkout for 30% off.
Before we get sort of into the next evolution of your work and what you're doing at startups and some of the things we were talking about, I want to go back to this conversation about swimming and approach it in a different way than we did before, because I know it's a huge part of your life. But what I'm more interested in is why you have this sort of relationship with water in particular, because I share that with you. There's something that is incredibly powerful about it to me, and I'm very curious, like, what it is about water in particular that draws you to it.
Oh, these are such good questions. And I realize I didn't even answer fully your previous question. But we can wind our way back to the past 3 years. We'll get there.
Yeah.
And if we don't, people can email me. You guys can just say, Sarah, you didn't answer the question. Okay, so water. Have you read the book Blue Mind?
Yeah. Well,
have you heard of
Wallace
it?
Nichols here as a guest before. Yeah.
Oh, amazing. Okay. Well, then you know more about this than me. But water. Do you know much about Ayurveda and yoga philosophy?
To some degree. We just had a guest here who whose episode will you guys will have heard by the time this is live. So, yeah.
Oh, amazing. Yeah. So there's different doshas or constitutions. There's Pitta, Vata, and Kapha. Did she or he talk about this?
Yeah.
Okay, great. So I'll build on this, which is I'm a Vata Pitta. And a Vata personality type is like airy and windy and kind of outer space. And so for me in particular, water feels like a container. It feels like it's finally holding me in one place. And once you have some sort of structure or container, and to me, it's actually just the sensitivity of my skin. So when I have something that's touching my skin, whether it's a weighted blanket or a bath or a massage or like yoga in a certain way, once that condition is met or once I'm walking around, it grounds me. It starts to pull me down. And it feels like first I have a container around my body, and then second that my mind and my body begin to get into sync. Because otherwise I feel like they're spinning at different speeds. And when I lose my mind and my body, when they get distorted and separated from each other, that's when I feel the most like jittery. That's when my anxiety can come up. That's when my depression can come up. That's when I start to feel like I get a lot of insomnia. I don't sleep. When I get insomnia now, I have a whole bunch of tools that I use. First, I write. I just open up a journal. I write for 30 minutes to get a bunch of stuff out of my mind. And then I start moving in yoga. And if that doesn't work, I take a shower. And then I'm back to sleep. And I just notice how fascinating it is that each of these processes are about moving ideas and pieces and things and even matter, cellular matter, through my body. to create some sort of peaceful stillness.
Wow. You brought up depression. I couldn't let that go. I'm curious. I wasn't familiar. I didn't know that. So I'm curious. I didn't know that you'd dealt with it at all.
Yeah. So I use it both in the colloquial sense of like, oh, I was having a rough day, or like I'm having a hard week. And then also my particular affliction, if you will, is probably a tendency to be high strung and anxious. Like I've always had a little bit of insomnia. In college, I had a lot of insomnia. And that's when I started taking Benadryl, which is essentially Tylenol PM. It was associated particularly with performance anxiety. So we would have a series of back-to-back swim meets, and it would be a lot of pressure, and I'd be up, like, nervous until 2 a.m., and I'd have to get up at 5 a.m. to go swimming. But one of the things I realized, this was kind of a huge aha moment in my swimming career that applies to everything, like it applies to this conference I was just at 3 days ago, is that everybody out there is operating under an imperfect set of circumstances. Like I got up on the blocks and I realized that it's more than likely that most of these people haven't gotten a proper night's sleep, and that getting a proper night's sleep is great, but it's not a prerequisite for success. Like you just do the best you can with what you're given. But so in terms of depression, I had some pretty rough depression. Speaking of middle school, in high school, like my freshman year of high school, I was really, really struggling. My parents had just separated, and they abruptly moved us out of the house, and we were living in a new place. I went to try out for the high school water polo team, and then I quit within 2 weeks. And then I just really withdrew into myself. I tried to make some friends. I had a really hard time making friends in my high school, early high school days. And it's funny because if I talk to people now who knew me in high school, they don't know that to be true. They don't see that. They weren't like witness to my inner life. But I was really withdrawn, and my mom got really worried about me, and she took me to a couple of therapists, and they recommended immediately to put me on antidepressants. And when I was that age, I said no. I was like, no, I don't want to just numb myself. I don't want to medicate. I don't think that's the answer, which I'm really grateful that I chose that. Even though medication can work for some people, I thought it was kind of a blunt answer, like catch-all for something that felt more complicated. And then when I was in college, one of the things that I did that was so helpful to me, and I recommend this to everybody, like college counselors and therapists are so cheap. Either they're free because they have one on site on school, or what they were for us was like $25 a session, which maybe feels expensive when you're in school as a student, but I don't know, pick up a side job, like work a cash register just to be able to pay for that. Because so this is super important to me, and I want to emphasize this and maybe talk about it more. The ability to have an expert look at your mind and analyze what's going on and uncover the depths and ask you provoking questions and guide you through maybe really uncomfortable matter, but towards a lighter side is one of the privileges of a lifetime. And there's a stigma associated with depression, like, oh, this is bad, or there's something wrong with you. And I think the privilege of working with a psychologist, I've worked with one now for, I don't know, how old am I? 33, so almost 20 years on and off, is one of the tenets of why I think my writing is where it's at and my intelligence is where it's at, is because this one-on-one work with a guided person has been unbelievable. And I was at the coffee shop across the street, and somebody was like, oh, what's your day? And I was like, oh yeah. Then I go to therapy. And he was like, oh, like it was this bad thing. And I realized that I live in this bubble where it's not a bad thing. And it's, to me, it's not a stigma. I think it's absolutely wonderful to talk about. And if you look at the creative histories of any artist, right? Like there's a lot of suffering going on, and there's a lot of angst and neuroses. I mean, what does it take to have Van Gogh cut off his ear, right? Mm-hmm. So it's just, I don't know. I think it's such an opportunity. And it's, again, something I'm really passionate about, is like, it should not be an elite privilege.
Yeah.
Like therapy and mental health is something that should be available and readily available and accessible to everyone.
Wow. Well, thank you for that. That was beautiful. Let's get back to your work.
Sure.
What you have been up to. I mean, because I know you worked at a startup and you know, you were talking about the research that you've been doing. So let's spend some time talking about what you've been up to and kind of, you know, and what is the underlying theme of your work now? Because, you know, mm-hmm. I'd always kind of seen you as a writer. And of course, our animated short pretty much demonstrated that. but, as I've sort of gotten to know you and kind of witnessed everything you've done, it's become much more multifaceted. So I'm curious, you know, where all that has taken you.
Yeah. So earlier I was talking about the courses that I had taught. So when I moved to New York City, because my now husband, the guy I was dating and wrote, you know, constructed out of a piece of paper, if you will, lived in New York City. He lived in Brooklyn. I moved across the country and we got together. I launched my own business again, officially, and I started teaching courses and doing some consulting with people, mostly working with CEOs to tell their stories. So I got to work with a lot of really smart, really talented people. I worked with a Presidential Innovation Fellow on her book, which was really amazing. A startup here in New York City, I knew a couple people in the startup scene, and they were looking for somebody who could teach and write. And I said, great, you know, I'm from Silicon Valley. I tried to get away from that, but bring it on. Let's do it. And I joined the startup scene. And very quickly, I realized how much overlap there is between thinking about interpersonal communication and systems design. And my background, I think we talked about this on the last podcast, but I spent 5 years as an architect. I actually went to 3 years of graduate school for city planning, which is by and large a study in systems and a study in systems thinking. Mm-hmm. How does traffic flow? How does traffic move? How do people move? Where are the green spaces? How do you coordinate everything? What are the economics of it all? What do you plan for? What are the policy? What are the edges? What are the constraints? Very applicable and very related to startup design and business design. Mm-hmm. So when I was at this startup, I started a couple years ago, 2.5 years ago, I was the sixth hire, and then we grew to 12 people, and then we added like 15 contractors between teachers and technologists and PR representatives and you name it. And so all of a sudden we were this team of 35, and I was promoted to the first VP. So we went from a relatively flat organization to, oh gosh, we need organizational structure. We need to figure out like who reports to who and how do we keep this streamlined and what does it mean to grow a team from 5 people to 10 people and 20 people. And I started along with Matan. I think you've had him on the show too. Matan Grafal. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's brilliant. So we started looking at systems design and leadership design and management design and what does it mean and how does it work? And one of the things we did was we started mapping the connection points among individuals. So on a team of 5, and this is where it gets like just mind blowing in kind of an obvious but non-obvious way. On a team of 5, you have like, you know, that game where it's like you have 5 people. How many pairs of 2 can you make? Mm-hmm. Like pop quiz. Well, I'll let everyone like guess and write it on a napkin. Da 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 da. Right? But it's 10. You have 10 points of connection on a team of 5. And you're like, okay, well, with 10 points of 10 pairs of people in any configuration, you can still talk to everybody at the table. You can still sit around a table and interruptions aren't a problem. You can Slack somebody, you can email somebody, you can like move Google Docs around, you can walk by somebody's table, and you have all the information you need. And you don't necessarily need a robust system. You don't need to externalize the information. You don't need like a wiki and a set of processes. When you get to 10 people, when you double in size, you have 45 connections, and those are just pairs. And then when you double again to 20 people, there's 190 permutations of pairs of people. Mm. And what that means is your startup starts to feel like a really bad game of telephone gone wrong. Like you don't know who's making decisions. You don't know how the decisions are made. You might be frustrated because you used to report to the CEO and see him every day, and now you have an intermediary. Somebody might have been hired, and you're like, wait, this isn't what I signed up for. And as the CEO of this organization, you will feel like there'll be a moment of surprise, because what happens here is your first person quits, and you weren't expecting it. So this is the situation that I was in, and we started mapping it and studying it and implementing new processes for how do you get the best out of a team. Mm-hmm. And We studied introverts and extroverts and meeting design and non-meetings and how do you communicate. And I have a whole list, like, Srini, our podcast could be like 8 hours long because I could go through each of the things that we did. But we started implementing external communication processes, which means where does the communication live? Because if the answer to a question lives inside somebody's head at 20 people, you're doing it wrong. That was such an important lesson for us to learn. It had to be documented. The results of a meeting couldn't just live inside of everybody's brain, but it had to be put somewhere. An internal blog, a wiki, a standardized decision-making process. And it's super frustrating for startups at this stage because what they're used to, their history, their knowledge of what it means to be their business is that they can move fast and break things and they can just reach out to anybody. And all of a sudden you go in and you add constraints and it can piss people off. But you have to move a little bit slower to keep moving fast. Because if you don't do these things, your startup actually really goes down and it becomes the pits and people start hating working there.
Yeah. So let's dial it back a little bit. I'm curious, how would one apply this entire sort of framework and context to their own life? And how do you do it in your personal life?
So these structures are all pretty similar in some regards. It's whether it's a network of friends or it's a family. Or it's a solopreneur with four contractors. Like, most of us can find an analogy or analogous situation that looks like this. So if you have more than one person who's making decisions, who makes the decisions? Or how are decisions made? And who owns each area? Like, my husband and I, we agree to divide and conquer. Because if we're both making both of the decisions all the time, or if we're both making decisions jointly all of the time, it leaves us no brain power and no space for creative things or fun things or reading books or basically things that light us up as human beings. Mm-hmm. So I take care of the food ordering. He doesn't give a damn, right? And he takes care of paying these bills over here. And like, I don't care. And we sit down and we map things out. And it's less gendered and more context specific. Because I happen to work from our home office and he commutes to work, there are things he cannot do at the home. Like, it wouldn't make sense. He couldn't do them until 6 p.m. or 7 p.m. when he got home. And because I happen to work from the home, I can take care of these things that are around here. And if it switches, which it probably will for many, many years to come, depending on who's traveling and who's doing what, we just continue to make the location and the decision making. We give each person an area of ownership. All right, you're going to take care of these things. You're going to take care of these things. And these are the things that we're going to check in on. And for a while, actually, in our early, early days of living together and me starting my business, we had a process called Scrooge, which you're allowed to spend $30 on anything. This is going to surprise people because I think people spend a lot more money than this, but you could spend $30 on anything without asking. But once we got to $30 or higher, we'd send a text to each other and we'd be like, does Scrooge approve? And Scrooge was this mythical creature in between the two of us that we both got to adopt and be. So I'd be like, hey, I think we need this $40 thing. What does Scrooge say? And he'd be like, Scrooge says maybe we should save that money for the vacation we want to go on. And I'd be like, damn, Scrooge, that asshole. and then that would be our kind of shorthand for whether or not we should spend money on something. And it took the personification of it, like, oh, you're the one who's saying no to me, or I'm the one who's saying no to you, out of it. And it let us also be reassured that money wouldn't just be disappearing somewhere else without knowledge. I think a lot of that frustration about who's making the decisions, how do you communicate around the decisions, is just a critical framework for all people, whether it's a startup or a company or a family unit or roommates.
Wow. This has been poetic, as I kind of expected it would be. I mean, I think we could talk for a good 2 or 3 hours if we really wanted to. I feel like this is one of those conversations that we'll have to revisit, and something tells me we'll have to bring you back again.
Another 3 years.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I want to finish with my final question, which is how we finish all of our interviews. And I'm very curious to see how this will have changed for 3 years later. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
I would say, I don't remember my last answer, by the way. I would say a commitment to the truth and a commitment to growth. So you're either James Clear, who I just watched give a talk this past week, talked about the 1% rule for growth. Every time you make a 1% improvement, and let's say you make one every single day or every single week, you add it into the bank and it builds like compound interest. So all of these micro small things that you're doing to improve yourself really add up if you have a dedication to them. And you'll see this in people who are making incredible work. And for me, some of the areas that I'm working on right now might seem really small, but they matter so deeply to me. And I think they are part of that 1% change. Like my integrity with my word. Will I show up when I say I'm going to show up? Do the words that come out of my mouth represent who I am and what I actually do? And so many times, I think there's just such a sloppiness with our integrity, with our word. People will say, oh yeah, see you later. And they have no intention of seeing you later. And I'll call you soon. And they never will. Or, yeah, I meant to get to that. Like I think that's one of the greatest afflictions of our time, aside from what the work that you're doing on attention and attention management and how important it is to be able to have sustained attention. I think the other coin of that is having integrity with your word. And that's what I mean by honesty. And if we're able to look at people and say something like, it was great to see you. And that's it, right? It was great to see you. Not, it's great to see you. I'll call you sometime. I'll send you that email. I'll do this other thing. And like constantly add garbage to our lives by promising, making all these broken promises. If we have integrity and honesty, and that even means honesty about ourselves. Like I got on stage the other day and I said, you know what? I'm a sweaty person, so I might have some pit stains and I don't care, right? And it's okay. As long as we have an honesty and integrity about looking inside of ourselves and being like, what is it that's actually true for me? What am I willing to put up with? What am I willing to stand for? And what do I not do? And can my words match that core of who I am? I think that makes somebody unmistakable.
Wow. Well, I think that makes a very fitting end to our conversation. Where can people learn more about you and your work?
Sure. All my stuff is online at sarahkpeck.com. It's all on my website. And that's the moniker I use all over the internet. So Twitter is Sarah K. Peck. Instagram is Sarah K. Peck. And then my newest work is a media company called Startup Pregnant. So it chronicles the year of being pregnant while working at a startup and having my first kid and how the creative process of birthing kids, birthing companies, whatever it is transformative. And it actually has a lot related. So if people want to read about that, they can find me at Startup Pregnant.
Awesome. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.